This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Ginkgo Biosecurity, whose cutting-edge biological intelligence platform empowers national security decision-makers to identify and respond to emerging biological threats.
Welcome to another episode of Intelligence Matters. Today, my co-host Andy McCreadis and I talk about the intelligence community's 2024 Worldwide Threat Report. We're going to share what we found interesting, what made us think differently, and what more we would like to know. I'm Michael Morrell, and we will be right back with that discussion after a quick break.
Biosecurity matters. What's biosecurity? It's the mission-critical industry safeguarding against 21st century biological threats. Biology doesn't respect borders. Ginkgo Biosecurity monitors critical assets and produces actionable biointelligence for national security decision-makers confronting biological threats, whether they are natural, accidental, or malicious. Ginkgo's technology tracks deadly pathogens worldwide, and our globally scaled platform, the first of its kind, detects outbreaks in near real time, deploys AI-powered threat assessments, and identifies the source of a threat, mitigating outbreaks before they become national emergencies. When lives and livelihoods are on the line, every second counts. Ginkgo Biosecurity, the biosecurity partner for an uncertain new era. Learn more at biosecuritymatters.com.
Andy, welcome.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing today?
I'm good. You know, I love these joint episodes where you and I are just on chatting. I really like them. And I like talking, believe it or not, I like talking about the Worldwide Threat Report.
You're like in a rare group of people who really talk about this stuff.
You know, I spent, Andy, years writing sections of the report. I spent years reviewing, you know, the entire report, asking poor people to make changes, and then I used it right in front of Congress.
In your last job, yeah.
Yeah, sure. a lot of experience. So
Michael, I helped write a lot of NIEs. I don't like talking about NIEs. So,
well, I think this says something about me, actually.
Okay.
Not about Worldwide Threat Reports. So, Andy, perhaps the place to start is to tell people what is Worldwide Threat Report.
Yeah. So this is I used to be the director of CIA. You know, now the DNI, who takes a look at the world and tries to narrow down what are the big challenges facing U.S. national security over the coming year. So there's a little bit of prognostication in there, looking back to see if it'll help you to look forward. And it does cover the waterfront, as you've seen in this report, everything from near peer adversaries, other adversaries, technology, environmental change, so they cover a lot of territory in the report.
Yeah. There's a classified version, right? That is typically drafted first, that goes to the two intelligence committees on the Hill, and then out of that classified version is crafted an unclassified version. And for people who actually want to read it, stay up at night reading it, you can go to the DNI's website and you can find it there. But you're right, it's what the intelligence community thinks about the most important issues. It covers all of them. It covers all of them in some depth. And so it's a good touch point every year for what does the intelligence community think? And I've always seen it as a great public service on the part of the intelligence community, because it level sets us, right, who don't see the intelligence every day, don't see the analysis every day. It gives us a sense of where they're at. So let's dig into this. Let's take turn raising things that fit into the categories that I mentioned. And let's start with what we found to be most interesting, most important. Why don't you go first?
Okay.
So, you know, I got to say that just reading the first line of the foreword gave me a little pause, and I thought it was interesting, but I disagreed. And what it says is that United States faces an increasingly fragile global order. Increasingly complex, yes. Increasingly dangerous, agree. Fragile has a sense that things could just break. And I'm just not sure that I, you know, sort of align with that view.
Would you say fraying?
Fraying, yes. Yeah, fragile, just, you know, you're thinking about an egg, right? And it doesn't take much to crack it. And I think things are a bit more resilient than that. Is it fraying? Certainly fraying on the edges, for sure. Are the challenges more dynamic and different than anything we faced in the last, 40, 50 years? Yes. But I'm not sure I'm on board with fragile. I don't know. Maybe you disagree.
No, I'd say fraying. And this is what's interesting. What the listeners should take away, these are the kind of conversations that you have, right? When you're putting the report together and when you're reviewing the report, you know, should it be fragile? Should it be fraying?
Okay, Michael, right now the listeners are like rolling their eyes. Are you guys kidding me?
I know. Keep going.
You know, what else I thought was particularly interesting was, again, just in the foreword here, that they call this a tumultuous period. I couldn't agree more. And it says, will be shaped by whoever offers the most persuasive arguments for how the world should be governed, how society should be organized, which systems are most effective at advancing economic growth and providing benefits. So, well, you know, I don't know about telling people how to order their societies. You know, that might be a bit of a stretch. But what that made me think about, why I found it interesting, is because this is a place where U.S. soft power seems to have an enormous advantage, right? Not the, you know, the hard power that we often talk about, but the, you know, the influence of the U.S. broadly, the attraction of the United States to so many people around the world. Because when you look at the other systems, and we'll talk about that as we get into the report, there are deep flaws in the others as it's articulated in the report, at least the competitors, if you will. So I thought, even though they don't say anything about soft power and anything like that, it sort of made me think maybe in slightly more optimistic terms about how things could play out.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. One of the things that jumped out to me that I found to be both interesting and important is early on in the report, there's a point made that I think is very important about the perceptions of adversaries. And let me just read it here, just a couple sentences. It says, often U.S. actions intended to deter foreign aggression are interpreted by adversaries as reinforcing their own perceptions that the United States is intending to contain or weaken them. And, you know, that's a general point about adversaries. But then a couple pages later, it gets very specific about China. And let me read it again. It says, China views Washington's competitive measures against Beijing as part of a broader U.S. diplomatic, economic, military, and technological effort to contain its rise, undermine Communist Party rule, and prevent the PRC from achieving its regional and global power ambitions. You know, and people might say, well, why do you think that's important, Michael? And the answer is, you know, because perceptions, you know, determine behavior and determine policy, and misperceptions can take countries, you know, in the wrong direction, and they can become self-fulfilling prophecies, right? They can become vicious circles. You know, we've talked about Steve Cole's new book about how Iraq and the United States over Saddam's entire rule did not understand each other, misperceived each other, right? And that led to two wars. And that really got me thinking about this whole issue of misperceptions, that, you know, they're very, very important. And, you know, it's something that we as intelligence analysts look like, but it really got me thinking about how do policymakers read the two paragraphs that I just read? And how do they think about what the right policy action is in response to a country misperceiving the United States? You know, what's their responsibility for correcting those misperceptions? How hard do they try? You know, I don't remember a lot of conversations in the sit room about correcting misperceptions beyond trying to convince the Pakistanis that India was not their mortal enemy and that terrorists and their poor economic performance was much more their enemy. But that's the only one I can remember. So I'm really interested in if there are policy discussions about how we can fix the misperceptions our adversaries have of us.
So, Michael, this is a real interesting point. And, you know, one place where I really focused on it was on China, as you did, but it was in a different section on China. It was on their WMD section. There's a line in there that was really interesting to me, and it says, Beijing worries that bilateral tension, U.S. nuclear modernization, and PLA conventional capabilities have increased the likelihood of a U.S. first strike. So talk about, I mean, it's not even in our thinking
right
here, right? But what the intelligence community is saying is it's in the Chinese thinking.
Yeah.
That we might be first strike.
Just another great example of this, right?
Right, right.
And so what does that get China to do that they wouldn't have done otherwise?
Right. What are
and
the
and how
yes.
do we read that? Right. And how do we react to that? That's why it's a spiral effect.
Yeah, spiral is a matter of fact. It's jotted down on the margins here. Spiral.
Yeah.
Right. Because I just don't I don't think you can just say to them, actually, we're not doing that,
or right.
we're, you know, that might even raise their suspicions more, right?
Yeah.
And so you've got this cycle of distrust and mistrust, and I think it's a huge policy challenge to figure out ways to, get that out of the system.
Just to make your point, in the Cole book, we, the United States, told the Iraqis that we were not in any way helping the Iranians in the Iran-Iraq war, and Saddam didn't believe us. He's like, no way, right? They're working both sides here. They're playing both sides. And we say, no, we're not. And then we get caught in the Iran-Contra affair. And Saddam says, see, I knew it. So these perceptions really matter.
Yeah, and it cloudies, policymaking.
Yeah. And I have not seen an academic treatment of this issue. I haven't seen an academic treatment of policy options. Anyway, I'd love to know to what extent the U.S. government is thinking about this fundamental problem, because any number of countries, China, North Korea, Iran, right, there are absolutely perceptions and misperceptions here that we would be better off if our adversaries didn't have them. Do you have another in this category?
So if we're just sticking with China for the moment, there's a couple things that I saw. Yeah, there's a judgment in there that they will be capable in the space arena, with a few exceptions. They call them world-class status, by 2030, which is interesting. Oh yeah, we've all known that they've been making it. The Chinese have been making advances here, but for the U.S., space has been our domain probably since just before the fall of the Soviet Union.
And you would assess, Andy, that we're still ahead.
Oh
at
yeah,
this moment.
Yeah, we're still ahead. So
yeah.
So this is so maybe it's that little bit of the guilty knowledge kind of thing. Reading this is a little jarring. 2030 is 6 years away. And the line says, world-class status in all but a few space technology areas. And so I thought that was a really interesting judgment. I'd love to know, what went into that thinking, because of not only what the U.S. government is doing, but also, you know, the commercial sector in the United States, you know, advancing space capabilities. So if they've taken all that into account, that's a, I think that's a particularly big judgment, again, because this was our domain, really, for the last, what, 40 years, 30 years?
Yeah.
So other things that I saw on the China side that I thought were interesting there's a line in the piece that says, it's talking about Beijing and Moscow, and it says they have made only minor enhancements to interoperability in successive exercises, which is a bit heartening, right? Because I think there's this perception, well, they're working together, you know, they're united, and I think the idea that they haven't been able to figure out how to do this interoperability thing is you know, that's a good point for us.
Yeah.
I think, and it's sort of interesting, and it might go against what sort of maybe popular belief is. And then the last thing I'll say about China, and the thing that I found particularly concerning, was the section on malign influence operations. I just thought that, there's three bullets there, and each one, you know, builds on the previous from Beijing's growing efforts to exploit U.S. societal divisions, China's demonstrating high degree of sophistication and influence activity and AI, and intensifying efforts to mold U.S. public discourse. I think those are particularly concerning in an open and free society like ours, where these things can creep in and begin to influence the way people think and look at subjects everywhere from, you know, Taiwan to, you know, you name whatever, you know, issue that the Chinese want to influence, and the one that they're, you know, I'm not sure what the defense is, other than awareness, encouraging people to be critical thinkers about what they see and read.
But that
you know, it's sort of a subtle but dangerous thing, I think.
Yeah. So I had a couple on China too. And I put them in the category of parts of the report that got me to think differently. And both of them are worrisome. The first one is that I always, my own personal assessment was that China would not use its cyber capabilities against U.S. critical infrastructure and military assets unless we were at war. But the report said that if Beijing believed that a major conflict were imminent, it would, now it gets a little mealy-mouthy here in terms of the words, it would consider aggressive cyber operations before military hostilities, right? And that they would do so to deter U.S. military action by impeding our decision-making, inducing societal panic, and interfering with the deployment of forces. So this is a different point than where my personal assessment has been, right? And it's worrisome.
Yeah, 100%. And it feeds into that, the earlier thing we discussed about their concern of U.S. first strike.
Right.
So that they may be motivated to take these actions because they fear a first strike. Yeah. So
this is a first strike, right? This is a first strike by them, right?
Yes, it is.
And
yes,
it's because they fear that first strike.
Right.
Yeah. No, this all comes together here. The second one for me is, you know, we knew about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, Bill Burns in an interview raised this issue. He said year and a half ago that China was considering providing lethal support to Russia for its war in Ukraine, and that was designed, right, to get the Chinese to think about that, to get the Chinese to know that we're monitoring them, right? And it was clear that the Chinese backed off from that. But the report says that China is providing economic and security assistance to Russia's war in Ukraine through, not direct lethal support, but through support to Russia's defense industrial base, including by providing dual-use material and components for weapons. So that's the first time that I had seen that, right? That the Chinese are actually providing parts for weapons and providing assistance that helps Russia build its defense industrial base, right? So this told me that the Chinese are providing more support to Russia's war effort in Ukraine than I thought they were. I shouldn't be surprised, right? But
I was surprised by a similar issue in the next section of the report on Russia, when it laid out the amount of bilateral trade between Russia and China, which I had no idea was $220 billion in 2023. I just took a look at U.S. bilateral trade. That's on the order of our trade with Japan.
Yeah.
So it's an enormous amount.
Yeah, and then just one sentence after the sentence about what China's doing to help Russia, it says, trade between China and Russia has been increasing since the start of the war, and Chinese exports of goods with potential military use rose more than threefold from 2022 to 2023. Right?
Yeah. I mean, clearly there's an imbalance. Well, I mean, the Chinese are importing energy.
Yeah.
Right. That's what they're getting from the relationship with Russia.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Chinese exports, right, of goods with potential military use tripled in 1 year. Tripled. Now, we don't know the base, so you don't know
how significant that is.
But it sounds, you know, it sounds significant. Anything else on China?
No, I keep being reminded. I keep being reminded of the demographic problems in China, and there are several sentences in this report that talks about declining birth rate, marriage rates are declining, negative population trends, shrinking labor force. Those are, we need to be reminded of those every now and again. These are enormous, not easily fixable domestic problems inside China that will take their toll over time.
Andy and I are talking about the intelligence community's 2024 Worldwide Threat Report. We'll be right back with more after a break.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
Let me just throw one more thing out there that it's a little surprising to me and requires me to admit that I was wrong about something, which I think is very important for people to do. When we left Afghanistan, I was with a fairly large group of people who believed that Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan would rebound fairly quickly and would become, in a matter of a year to 2 years, a threat again to the West. And in the report, there's a sentence in the, I think it's the terrorism section, that says Al-Qaeda has reached an operational nadir in Afghanistan and Pakistan, right? Al-Qaeda has reached its lowest point in those two countries. It doesn't say since when, but it sounds, like over a long period of time. So it really sounds like the intelligence community's view, and I have no reason to doubt them, right? The intelligence community's view that Al-Qaeda has not bounced back, as many of us thought. And that's important to acknowledge, important to understand why. They don't explain why, but it's important to understand why.
Right. And will they be supplanted by somebody?
ISIS-K, right?
ISIS-K?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Which brings us, I think, to a whole bunch of things that I think for you and me, where we read something and we thought, that's really interesting. I'd like to know more. And ISIS-K is one of those where they don't say very much at all about ISIS-K in this report. So they have a very explicit point about where Al-Qaeda stands, but they don't say anything, very little about ISIS-K. They don't acknowledge the attempted attack in Western Europe that was foiled in Germany. They don't mention the attack in Iran in early January. So it left me wanting to to know more about what does the IC think about ISIS-K and the threat it poses to Western Europe and the U.S. homeland?
Yeah, you know, similarly, there's a few things that caught my attention in that vein. And one of them was, which I would love to read more about, is Moscow's or Russia's weakening relationships on its periphery. They touch on it, right? But this intense focus on Ukraine clearly has got, you know, some of the states on the periphery, you know, maybe looking at other places other than Russia. And that would be a really interesting dynamic to you know, understand. I mean, they talk in there about Nagorno-Karabakh and the Armenians, but they also suggest that there's other, you know, weaknesses in what used to be the, you know, states that Russia influenced or controlled over time. So that, you know, it left me wondering about, you know, where do they begin to align? Do these become new challenges for the Russians while they're overly focused on one country, Ukraine? You know, how does that play out over time? Seems to me would be an interesting discussion.
Yeah. One in that category for me is very, you know, one sentence that really caught my attention. It says, Beijing will use even stronger measures to push back against perceived increases in U.S. support to Taiwan. Stronger measures, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're already using strong measures, right?
Yeah.
The much higher level of military exercises, Chinese military exercises against Taiwan, the recent incursions into the territorial waters of Kinmen Island, which is close to China but belongs to Taiwan. So when they say stronger measures, what are they thinking about?
Yeah, what are those?
Yeah,
you know, so I was just in Taiwan, and one of the things that some of the military people in Taiwan, you know, really do believe is that all these things that the Chinese are doing are just to continue to weaken you, right? The continued pressure, continuing making you react. And given, you know, the disparity in size and capabilities, a lot of the Taiwan military leaders just believe that this is just a wear down,
yeah,
kind of campaign,
yeah,
to keep you at this heightened sense all the time until we eventually wear you down without, you know, having to take any other bigger kinetic actions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's China's strategy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, another one in that vein for me was, there's a sentence talking about Chinese economic growth, and it says it's going to continue to slow. And it says, thanks to demographic challenges and a collapse in consumer and investor sentiment. And, you know, one of those is long-term secular in nature, right? The demographic challenges. And the other is more macroeconomic, cyclical, right? I really want them to separate those two, right? The short-term macroeconomic cyclical will have effects like China pushing exports, right, to keep growth up. The long-term secular is actually more important, and I'd love to know what the analysts at CIA think about what do they think is going to happen to Chinese growth over the longer term, right? Because it's not just demographic challenges. It's bigger than that. And so do they think that, you know, Chinese growth, long-term growth is going to be, you know, 2-3%, or do they think it's going to be 5%? Big difference, right? So that sentence there where they mix those two together really got me thinking. I'd love to see those separated.
So great point. When we were in the building, both you and I were in the building, the discussion was when does China overtake the U.S. economy? It's now starting to sound more like will or if.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to when.
Yeah. It'd be great to know what they think about that, right?
Yes, it would be.
Those are very good analysts. I'd love to know what they think about that.
They're very good. They're excellent. Yeah.
You know, the last thing that jumped out at me, Andy, was there's a sentence where, remember, the Chinese perceptions were that we had a coordinated approach, right, to holding them back, to containing them. There's also a sentence that says they have a coordinated approach, right, to strengthen their rule, to secure what they believe is their sovereign territory, to achieve what they want to achieve in regional preeminence, and that they're using their military power, diplomatic power, economic power, and technological power in a coordinated way, right, to achieve their foreign policy goals. And I read that and I'm like, really? Right? How many countries actually have a coordinated policy? You know, I'm wondering if we're giving them too much credit, just like they're giving us too much credit, right, for having a coordinated policy and holding them back. It's just sometimes I think we give countries more credit. You know, again, having sat in the sit room for as long as I did, it's really hard for the U.S. to have a coordinated policy on anything, right? So anyway, that just jumped out at me.
No, that's – so when I teach one of the classes I teach at the Bush School, one of the things we talk about is this bias towards – believing there are centralized control. And I think we do that all the time. And we sort of think that, you know, just because it's an authoritarian state, they have complete control and they're coordinating with other authoritarian states. And yeah, maybe a little bit, but yeah, I think we do sometimes overplay that. But on the other hand, I really do believe that our adversaries do the same when they look at us.
Yeah,
right, we're 10 feet tall to them. So I think that's interesting. Just one last point before we leave this. One of the interesting themes, if we go back to the earlier thing that I said about the report where it said, you know, it depends on who's going to make the best case for, you know, their system. If you look at the adversaries or challengers, or whatever you want to call them, China, they articulate in the report, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. The internal problems in these countries are enormous. I mean, we might look around the U.S. and say, hey, we have a lot of challenges inside. We do. But when you stack them up compared to what we're looking at, and, you know, even more so in China now than probably in the last few years, those problems are becoming much more visible.
I agree with you 100%. I don't think that there are large chunks of the world who are looking at the United States and Western Europe and comparing them to Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. They're just not, right? People are trying to leave those four countries, including China, right?
Right.
People are emigrating from China. People are emigrating from Russia. People are emigrating from Iran in large numbers. And people would love to emigrate from North Korea, but
if they could.
You know, they're afraid. You know, so it's not just economic performance. It's where's freedom, right? Where's democracy? And so I think we're probably overstating that competitiveness, right? Certainly we're competing with all these countries in extraordinarily important ways, but I'm not sure that whether China has 5% growth or 2% growth long term is going to determine how the rest of the world wants to organize its economy and its politics.
Agree 100%.
Yeah. Anything else on your list?
Just the section on technology and disruptive technologies.
Yeah, I thought you'd have views on that. I mean, you are the tech guy.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the idea that these technologies, it's not only a competition with countries like China, but also the report talks about, you know, digital authoritarianism and how these technologies turned inward have a huge potential to be repressive. And sometimes people don't think about this, But as these technologies get more and more sophisticated and especially generative AI, what it will allow rulers of countries, not just China, but you name the others, to really control their populations is rather sobering. I think in a flat-out technological race, the U.S. wins. I don't have any doubts about that. But what countries can do inside with some of these technologies is quite frightening. There's a lot of discussion about you know, AI and other emerging technologies, there's discussion about biotech. There's some others. What sort of seems to be missing is the convergence of AI and some of the WMD capabilities. And does that is there an advantage there to people that we haven't seen before?
Yeah.
Especially on bio.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that kind of thing. And you know that a bunch of the US tech companies, you know, sort of said that they would try to put guide rails on AI and chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear were called out specifically in those agreements with the White House. So it's not a big section in the report, but it's one that's, I think, concerning. Yeah. And where the U.S. has to find the right balance between, you know, regulation and competitiveness on these technologies so that we don't lose the lead.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Agree 100%. Let me just close here with a couple of thoughts. One is I know that DNI, Avril Haines, that openness and transparency is important to her. And this report is a great example of being open and transparent on the part of the intelligence community. So, you know, I agree with that 100%, and this is a great example of that. The other thing is, since you and I are here rather than with a guest, I just want to take this moment to thank our producer, Steve Dorsey, who helps us tape these every week, who edits them, makes them sound good, makes us better, you know, sound better than we really sound. He does a great job every week. So, Steve, I just wanted to say thank you.
Michael, maybe we should like release a before and after sometimes so that everyone would know all the work Steve does to fix things and make them smooth.
Yeah, no, that we should absolutely do that. Steve, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining Andy and me. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.